Hi all, thanks so much for watching Making Healthcare Work for You, Different Perspectives and Empowering Solutions. I'm Stephanie Fields, joined by my co-host, Dr. Apoorv Gupta, and today we're welcomed by Kenzie Butera Davis, who is the founder and CEO of Morro. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Morro is targeting mental health for children. You said early detection, prevention. So why don't you just tell us, what is Morro?
So you're spot on. We're focused on early intervention and risk detection when it comes to youth mental health. And the reason for that is, you know, we've done such a good job of investing in remote virtual access to teletherapy and telepsychiatry solutions for families. And these solutions are still very much growing. And we love the access that they've brought, but they're still very much focused on sort of this point of care. And so the aspect of the youth mental health crisis that Morro is really focused on is this 8 to 11 year window where kids are struggling. They are showing symptoms that maybe are not so obvious when you don't know to look for them. And it's taking an average of 8 to 11 years, and that's 2022 data, for kids to get from, hey, they're showing symptoms, to actually reach their first intervention or first point of care. And that window is what Morro is really solving for.
It's really interesting, Kenzie, what you're talking about, because you said that Morro's really using some validated instruments that already exist. And then applying them in a unique way, distributing them in a unique way. So I guess I'm intrigued to understand why is the problem currently being missed if the instrument's already available, and is it the distribution mechanism ultimately, you know, that is the solution? Like, how do you think about that?
So a lot of kids there's this big sort of legislative push and cultural push to screen kids when they come in for their annual pediatric checkups, largely using the GAD-7, the PHQ-9 to screen for anxiety and depression. The challenge is you're still only seeing a pocket of kids who actually show up for their annual checkup. Now, we have addressed a lot of different youth health problems by incorporating screening into school, and we do this for academic challenges as well. So we'll screen students for their literacy ratings, you know, how are we going to sort them into different classes where some have more structure and support, some are more challenging. We do this for eyesight, we do this for scoliosis, but we don't do this for mental health. And I think that this is the unlock that enables us to identify kids when they're really struggling and before they're in crisis, when tools like building skills and coping mechanisms and maybe some therapy are more effective because you've caught it at a time when their symptoms are a lot more manageable.
What are some of those things? Because you mentioned before that, you know, some of the tools catch things that don't, and some of the symptoms that just go unrecognized. What are those things that it's checking for?
Yeah. So, a variety. I mean, you think about things like kids who are internalizing their symptoms. I think this is probably the best example to answer that question with. So what often happens in schools is, and I'm going to reference school since that's a big part of where Morro sits, is you have kids who are acting out in class. They're, you know, behavioral challenges that make it really difficult for teachers to teach. And the teacher immediately knows something's going on. I've got to get extra support for this child. And all of those kids end up in the counselor's office at some point. What is being missed is you have a lot of kids where their symptoms they're more internal. Maybe their grades start to slip a little bit. Like a high performing child, their grades start to slip. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're high performing, but they're anxious and they're perfectionist. And that leads to often we see kids with eating disorders that fit that sort of archetype. So the reason I say it's a challenging question to answer is because it's those kids who are internalizing symptoms where the symptoms are truly just not obvious. And what these screeners and surveys do is they allow us to have the child actively thinking about, well, have I actually started to lose passion for the things that I love over the past month or, you know, couple of weeks? And am I really not sleeping well anymore? And we just kind of get them attuned to checking in with their own thoughts, their body, their activities. And now we have a record of, well, at this time, the child felt like they were really passionate, doing really well. Then something happened in seventh grade. And all of a sudden, those scores started to slip. And we want to jump in and ask the right questions so that we can help that child if they need it.
Yeah, that's fairly helpful, Kenzie. And I think you probably already started to get into it, but earlier you had said that you are already in several school systems and maybe have some case studies. So this might be a good point to sort of tease that out a little bit, is what are you actually finding as you're implementing this, and maybe share some of those success stories with us?
Yeah, so, you know, I we're constantly thinking about health equity in this the broader scope of MARO, and how are we not only reaching kids and identifying what they're struggling with, but making sure they get to a provider that's going to match their needs, you know, and what they can afford. So one of my favorite examples is we did this case study at a charter school in California with 120 kids, where the counselor started using MARO because she was using a survey before that didn't work. She was very aware that she has a high percentage of students that are struggling with suicidal ideation, but she had no data to prove it. And she tried using a different screener that's very popular in schools, but not clinically validated, and produces a lot of false positives for suicide. So it makes it very hard to get to kids who are really struggling. Well, in this particular population, she has a very high immigrant population and many kids who, as a part of their religious beliefs, it's a sin to have thoughts of suicide and, of course, to commit suicide. And so when she did this survey that was not MARO, it was asking specifically about suicidal ideation and behaviors and using the word suicide over and over. So none of her students showed up as positive, and she knew they had lied on the survey. Well, we don't use tools that are not clinically validated, and we actually don't specifically use the word suicide in our screeners. And we think that's really important. So when she used MARO's tools in school, she actually found that 16% of her students were struggling with suicidal ideation. And she was able to, you know, meet with those students, meet with their families, and for those that were open to therapy, get them into support.
So what do you do at that point? You said that you have these resources, you're working with these people. Are people receptive to it? You know, you alluded to the fact that there's different beliefs, different cultures, all these different things. And some populations, even different age groups, are more open to things than others. So How do you help them and show them that this is going to make a difference?
So one of the things that we do for counselors, and that this will lead into answering that question, is we have this sort of database that we've triaged all the kids in order of severity. So you can see, or we've, you know, said this child who is the most severe scores and was flagged for potential suicidal ideation is at the top, and so forth and so on. And it's very easy. You click a button that says refer this child. It takes you to a database of both virtual and community partners. And you can filter by insurance, sliding scale, the language a child speaks, all of these different factors to narrow down. And you click add to referral list, add to list, and it sends an email automatically to that parent with all of the information about those referrals. Now, the reason that I believe this helps families start to feel more comfortable is we can assess things like, are you okay with virtual therapy? A lot of kids feel more comfortable with that. A lot of families are okay with it. It's more accessible. And then for others, they say, we really need someone in person who speaks, our native language. Like, I want someone in person who speaks Russian. That's a real example case study that we dealt with. And so we just try to be very attuned to what the population we're serving is going to need. You still have families who are not going to be receptive to therapy. So what we try to do there is through our mobile app for families, which we give to all families at a school whenever we work with the school, has educational content that is meant to meet you where you're at with your level and comfortability and understanding of parenting and mental health. And then we have the ability for some families, and we're starting to roll this out. We partnered with this incredible company called Thread Health that staffs MDs who are pediatricians with an extra layer of training around adolescent medicine. And they're very good at talking to families who do have this stigma around mental health, assessing when physical concerns are more indicative of mental health concerns, you know, doing a mental health assessment, building trust, and then referring a child to specialists. That's how we're thinking about that challenge today.
It seems to be really well thought through, and I'm so sure that you're going to be able to identify a lot of kids who need the help this way. I have kind of like a flip side of that question, Kenzie. It's sort of, I'm thinking, you know, with my sales hat on, I'm thinking you're selling into schools, which is probably just as hard as selling into hospitals. So it's not an easy job. And you've got a lot of change management to do, because now, yeah, it's a great thing you're offering them this new tool, but yet it's another tool on top of probably myriads of tools that they already have access to. And you had mentioned earlier that they already have to do so much screening. So I guess my question to you is it easy enough to get the schools that you're working with to understand the need for this and incorporate this into their practice? Or are you finding it to be a challenge to convince them to add this to their regimen?
Well, I'm definitely, you know, I'm not going to lie. Nothing with K-12 is ever easy. And that's why we're doing it. I mean, I very much buy into the mantra of doing hard things when they're worthwhile. Schools, you've got your early adopters, those who are really ready to shift from a reactive to a proactive mindset. That's the phrasing that our customers use. And then you have those who are really overwhelmed, and really they have so many kids who are in crisis. And it's never a case of, do we need this or can we not make the argument? It's more, when can we implement this? You know, can we implement it over the summer so we're prepared for next year? Can we do it over winter break? They're just trying to find a break where they're not feeling so overwhelmed to start to make that transition. And I think that's always the challenge when you're in an industry where you're trying to go from not just focusing on the treatment aspect, but focusing on the prevention aspect. And what we're hearing is people are very open to it, but they're also very overwhelmed, and we have to work within those constraints.
What inspired you to do this? Because it's obviously something that you're really clearly passionate about, and it's such a specific group of kids. You know, is there a tipping point where we've lost them? Or, you know, if it gets to that 8 years down the road, is it too late? Can they still get help? But is it just a harder hill to climb? Or is this pivotal for a different reason? So kind of a couple of different things in there, but it's all, I guess, connected in my head.
Yeah, no, your question makes sense. So I'll talk about why, and then hold me accountable to speak a little bit more to the market behavior, because I think that will answer, and kind of the cost on the health plan side should answer some of those latter questions. So in terms of why Morrow was started, I have such a deep passion for supporting kids. I just think, you know, as you're developing, it's such a critical point of life, but it's also a point where you're very vulnerable. And being someone who is a child survivor of rape and sexual assault, you know, I spent a lot of time working with other survivors as a part of that healing process. In college, I worked for a rape crisis and domestic violence shelter. And as much as I was grateful for that experience, I was also very frustrated because I was on the reactionary side of this horrible problem, and there were just simply not enough resources for survivors. So I started thinking about proactive ways to support this community and wrote a dissertation on the implementation of health education in the US, because my hypothesis was if we educate more kids on consent, then we could decrease rates of rape and sexual assault. And of course, if we find ways to make schools compliant with Aaron's Law, which is intended to educate kids on abuse in the home and how to get help, then, you know, you can really meet kids earlier in those processes. Those learnings were very informative. I ended up going, it was just a research project. Ultimately, would have never defined it as customer discovery. I was just talking to so many schools and families and very hungry for that knowledge. Worked in startups for a while and you get the bug to be an operator. I decided to apply those learnings to mental health. I had family members who were really struggling with suicidal ideation and they were very young. It was hard to watch what led up to that. And then also how hard it was for them to get reintegrated into the school environment. Ultimately that's what led to what Mauro is today. And then to answer your latter question, and then I'll pause, is, you know, it's never too late, but it is significantly harder when you go from a child who has mild to moderate symptoms of, I'll stick with anxiety and depression, where you can teach them, give them skills, teach them, healthy ways to deal with big emotions so that they don't feel so impulsive. A lot of kids that we see who are committing suicide at early ages, when they feel a big emotion and don't know how to handle that, they feel very impulsive. And so they turn to self-harm. So there are just skills that we can give kids that really start to reduce those symptoms and make them less severe. When you get into kids who are really severely depressed, severely anxious, it's just harder because they have learned behaviors now and you're trying to kind of undo those behaviors. They may need medication now. It's very expensive for families and for health plans because now you've got a child who is in the ER for a suicide attempt. That's anywhere from a $3,000 to $14,000 bill right there. So that's kind of how I think about this from like a timeline perspective, but also just the cost savings opportunity, which I know a poor view probably can appreciate.
Yeah. There's so many kids that are struggling, so many of us that are struggling at a late age, you know, in our 40s, 50s, 60s, we're all struggling. This is a worldwide problem, anxiety, depression, loneliness, and, you know, you name it. I mean, so many illnesses that are sort of ultimately stemming from mental health issues. And I guess my question is this ultimately just need to become part of the core curriculum for a school instead of identifying people at risk? Are we not all at risk? And do we just not find a way to blend this into our social emotional learning curriculum so that everyone gets some element of protection? Probably something on your mind as well. So maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, that aspect of, you know, how well this really needs to be integrated into just the way we live and grow up and learn in general.
I love that question. And I completely, fundamentally believe that you have to have this as a part of core curriculum. And it doesn't mean you set aside another class or you're spending 20 to 30 minutes a day on this. It means integrating it into themes and topics that we talk about. So I always like to use the example because I think it's one that is a lot of high schoolers read, which is Romeo and Juliet. That's a perfect book in your English class to open up conversations about healthy relationships, about suicide. It's just a brilliant opportunity to say, hey, we have this thing that's already a part of our core curriculum. Well, why don't we start incorporating a little bit of conversation around mental health in this, you know, thing that we are already required to teach? We did build a mental health foundations curriculum. I think, you know, we've had, and this is in no way a knock to social emotional learning, which is building important skills, but we've had these SEL curriculums around for a long time. It's becoming increasingly trendy to incorporate them, but we've had them. And I felt very disappointed in the fact that I don't see those, I don't see a larger change happening, even though we've had these curricula in our systems to some extent, 10 to 15 years. And I think what's needed is to go a little bit further and to really focus on true mental health foundational skills, which is really coping, education, labeling things for what they are, that sort of more clinical content.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being here in this conversation. It was fantastic.
Thank you both so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Kenzie. Very well articulated. All the best to you in this venture.
And thank you all for watching. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.